Thank you, Annalise, for opening our service today. Our greetings to you, both of you who are here in the sanctuary this morning, and also to those of you who are tuning in via Zoom. The subject of gratitude on this Sunday that is prior to our Thanksgiving holiday will be the theme of this morning's service. And I'd like to begin then with one of my favorite poems on gratitude. It's a poem from the American poet E.E. Cummings, who on January 1, 1918, near the end of World War I, was released from a French prison on suspicion of being a spy. He wasn't, but he was imprisoned for a number of months and then reborn out of that prison darkness back into the light of the natural world. Later, the poet expressed his exceeding joy with these words. He said, "I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I who have died am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and of wings, and of the gay great happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing any, lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you, now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened." My reading this morning is from this book. It's titled, "Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story." But the title is somewhat misleading, because the actual question being addressed in this book is, why is there something rather than nothing? The author of this, it was a 2012 publication, is Jim Holt. He's a longtime contributor to the New Yorker magazine. He has written a number of articles on string theory, time, numbers, truth, and so forth. And I'm going to read a few paragraphs of the beginning of this book where he tells us how he started on this journey of trying to discover why there's something rather than nothing. And George, if you could put the words on the screen so you can follow along with me. So Jim Holt writes, "I vividly remember when the mystery of existence first swam into my ken. It was in the early 1970s. I was a callow and would-be rebellious high school student in rural Virginia, as callow and would-be rebellious high school students sometimes do. I had begun to develop an interest in existentialism, a philosophy that seemed to hold out hope for resolving my adolescent insecurities, or at least elevating them to a grander plane. One day, I went to the local college library and checked out some impressive-looking tomes, Sartre's Being and Nothingness, and Heidegger's Introduction to Metaphysics. It was in the opening pages of the latter book with its promising title that I was first confronted by the question, why is there something rather than nothing at all? I can still recall being bowled over by its starkness, its purity, its sheer power. Here was the super ultimate why question, the one that loomed behind all the others that mankind had ever asked. Where, I wondered, had it been all my admittedly brief intellectual life? It has been said that the question of why is there something rather than nothing is so profound that it would only occur to a metaphysician, yet so simple that it would occur only to a child. I was too young then to be a metaphysician, but why had I missed the question as a child? In retrospect, the answer was obvious. My natural metaphysical curiosity had been stifled by my religious upbringing. From my earliest childhood, I had been told by my mother and father, by the nuns who taught me in elementary school, by the Franciscan monks at the monastery over the hill from where we lived, that God created the world and that he created it out of nothing at all. That's why the world existed, That's why I existed. As to why God himself existed, this was left a little vague. Unlike the finite world that he had created, God was eternal. He was all-powerful and possessed of every other perfection to an infinite degree. So perhaps he didn't need an explanation for his own existence. Being omnipotent, he might have bootstrapped himself into existence. He was, to use the Latin phrase, causae sui, that is, a self-caused cause. This was the story that was imparted to me as a child. It is a story still believed by the vast majority of Americans. For these believers, there is no such thing as the mystery of existence. If you ask them why the universe exists, they'll say it exists because God made it. If you then ask them why God exists, the answer you will get will depend on how theologically sophisticated they are. They might say that God is self-caused, that he is the ground of his own being, that his existence is contained in his very essence, or they might tell you that people who ask such impious questions will burn in hell. But suppose you ask non-believers to explain why there is a world rather than nothing at all. Chances are, they also will not give you a very satisfying answer. Our meditative song this morning is titled Holy Now, and it's a song composed by Peter Mayer. You may recognize him as the composer of one of the favorite hymns in our teal-colored hymnal, Blue Boat Home. And like author Jim Holt, Peter Mayer's religious upbringing, as he experienced it, also suppressed his curiosity about the mystery of existence. I'm going to ask you to pay particular attention to the words in this song. Wine from water is not so small, but an even better magic trick is that anything is here at all. Well, the book I read from a few minutes ago, Why Does the World Exist, is one I was so pleased to come across a few years ago, because here was is an author who, as a young man, was seized by the same question that grabbed me as a young man. Jim Holt, the author, said that in the early 1970s, he had been bowled over by a question that he had come across in philosopher Martin Heidegger's book, Introduction to Metaphysics, the question, why is there something rather than nothing at all? Coincidentally, it was in the 1970s that I too had been struck by the very same question. Not directly from Martin Heidegger, but indirectly through a theologian who had been deeply influenced by Heidegger, namely Paul Tillich. As a theological student reading one day in this book, the three-volume work by Paul Tillich, I came across these simple words and the very direct question, why is there something rather than nothing? It was on page 163 of this volume. I looked at it still, all is really marked up. This question, wrote Tillich, has to do with what is called the first philosophy, the most basic philosophy you can get at. It has to do, he said, with the ontological question. Ontos is from the Greek being, so it's the question of being itself, being as being. And Tillich wrote then that this is about what is called the metaphysical shock. The metaphysical shock, that is, the shock of possible non-being. The possibility that there might have been nothing, nothing at all, nothing forever and ever and ever and ever. While reading this in Tillich, I did get a bit of a shock, and it was somewhat like the electric shock that I got as a youngster. I grew up on a small farm. I would try to slip under an electric fence in a pasture on a wet day, but not quite get down low enough, thus getting a quick jolt of electricity in the middle of my back. I remember that still, but with the metaphysical shock that that Tillich is talking about, I get reverberations still all the time. And so, as I say, I was pleased a few years ago to find this book by Jim Holt, where he gives himself up completely to the pursuit of this question, why is there something rather than nothing? So Jim Holt, the author, he read philosophers, both ancient and modern. He conducted phone interviews. He traveled to many places in the world to speak with philosophers, metaphysicians, physicists, cosmologists, novelists, basically anyone who he felt was seriously grappling with this question of why is there something rather than nothing? What kind of question is this? What answers to it are possible? What can you do with it? Where can such a question take you? Reading Holt's book some years ago and following his journey in pursuit of this question, it helped me in my own reflections, and I'd like to share a few of those with you this morning and where it has taken me. First, I've come to see that this question is typically approached by people in two different ways. Or in the first approach, the question is really not even a question at all, but it's more an expression of philosophical wonder and religious awe in the face of the fact of being. In contemplating the possibility that there might have been nothing, not you, not me, not this sanctuary, not this town, not this country, not this land, not this planet, not this system of star systems, a system of planets, not this vast universe, or any universe, or even any possibility of any possible universe. In contemplating this possibility of possible nothingness, one can be overcome by the fact that there is something rather than nothing. It seems that nothing had to be. And yet, here it is. Here we are. How is it possible? It seems like it might be impossible and almost beyond imagining and comprehension and comprehending. So in this way of approaching the question, you're not so really as much seeking an answer of the sort that we usually seek in asking a question. And yet, in another way, though no answer of the normal kind might be found, it may provide a different kind of answer in terms of feelings and emotions of wonder, awe, astonishment, humility, as one contemplates this question. So that's one approach to this question of why is there something rather than nothing. It's not really even a question in the normal way that we think of questions. A second way the question can be taken is to approach it as though there might actually be an answer to this question. That is, one can speculate, try to demonstrate why there's something rather than nothing, why it makes sense that there should be something rather than nothing, how it is that something emerged and evolved out of seeming nothingness, or to borrow the language from my opening words from E.E. Cummings this morning, where he says, how tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing any was lifted from the know of all nothing. And so scientists, cosmologists, mathematicians, physicists puzzle over and they try to answer these questions of the first philosophy in relationship to the so-called Big Bang at the origin of our universe. These scientists and cosmologists want to know, as Jim Holt rather roughly puts it, what banged? Why did it bang? And what was going on there before it banged? So in Jim Holt's book, he interviews a number of folks who have been working on these questions. And so they approach this question of why there's something rather than nothing from that, as if it might have actual literal answers. So these are two very different ways to approach this question of why is there something rather than nothing. I think it is helpful to try to recognize which of these two ways one might be approaching the question, because often in my experience, people get at cross purposes. They're answering the same question, but they're approaching it from such very different directions. Typically, I find that people tend to favor one approach over the other, are more interested in one approach over the other, and that might be understood as the clash or the tension between the philosopher and the scientist, the theologian and the cosmologist. Now, personally, as you might suspect, since I'm in the area of religion, I'm more drawn to the first approach to this question that I mentioned, that of religious awe and philosophical wonder. I'm still interested, though somewhat less interested, in trying to solve the question as if it were a literal puzzle. But I've come across those who, I have to say, are not at all interested in the way that I approach this question. Basically, they say, if it's an unanswerable question, why bother? Get on with your life. Or this. Why are you so astonished that something is rather than is not? Hey, it's a 50-50 proposition. It's like, it's chance, like the flip of a coin. Heads or tails? I suppose there might have been nothing, but it came up heads. So there's something. So big deal. What's the big deal? That's the other. Now, these two approaches to the question of why there's something rather than nothing correspond to two different ways of approaching mystery. There are two different basic ways, meanings, types of mystery. The one kind of mystery is the mystery of a puzzle, something that is not yet known, but could be known, something that is not yet solved, but could be solved. It's the kind of mystery, for example, you get in a mystery novel. So those who approach the question of why there is something rather than nothing as a question that might have a literal answer are approaching it with this sense of mystery. And indeed, that can be the adventure of a lifetime, as it is for many cosmologists and scientists. It's the adventure of trying to unravel this most basic mystery of all. But with this kind of mystery, if the puzzle ever were to be solved, then the mystery would be dissolved. No more mystery, as at the end of a mystery novel. However, there is a second kind of mystery that isn't about trying to solve a puzzle. And this is the mystery that I've spoken about of awe and wonder with respect to the simple astonishment that something is rather than is not. This kind of mystery is never dissolved. It only deepens with your acquaintance with the subject. Indeed, for many scientists, like an Einstein, for example, these two types of mystery ride in the same carriage, as it were. So that, like Einstein is doing, trying to solve certain riddles and dissolve certain mysteries, simultaneously, one's sense of awe and wonder is increased. And so Einstein can say, as he has, quote, "The most beautiful and deepest experience a person can have is the sense of the mysterious. It is the underlying principle of religion as well as all serious endeavors in art and science. And then another thing I've come to in my contemplation of this question of why there is something rather than nothing is a distinction between two different kinds of nothingness. Now we're going to go into the weeds here a little bit, but the ancient Greek philosophers had two terms for nothingness. Again, it's something I picked up from Paul Tillich. I'll make a print copy of this and send it to you. I'll put the technical Greek terms in there. But the one kind of nothingness that they're referring to is absolute nothingness. That's the kind of nothingness where there would never, ever be anything at all, no possibility of there ever being anything at all. And of course, if absolute nothingness had prevailed, we wouldn't be having this conversation this morning. So this is the kind of nothingness that relates more to the first approach I'm talking about, the simple astonishment that something is rather than is not. There is something, not nothing. The second kind of nothingness that the Greeks referred to is what you might call relative nothingness, or I like the term pregnant nothingness. And this is the kind of nothingness in which nothing currently exists, but which still holds the possibility that something might exist, which is obviously the kind of nothingness that has prevailed since we are having this conversation. More from my side than yours at this point. But this is the kind of nothingness that relates more to the second approach to the question, to that of the physicists and cosmologists trying to determine how it is that this universe of ours was able to emerge from a kind of pregnant nothingness. And this pregnant nothingness is similar to what we have in the Hebrew creation story, where Yahweh, according to the first chapter of the book of Genesis, created the heavens and earth out of pre-existing materials said to be waste and void. So this was not the creatio ex nihilo, creation out of absolute nothingness, as later doctrine declared, but rather creation with pre-existing materials, and Yahweh then being the creative artist. Actually, most, if not all, ancient creation stories seem to start with pre-existing materials. It appears that most of the ancients weren't interested, or at least they didn't publicly talk about the question of where the original raw materials for creation came from. When it came to the question of where those basic pre-existing materials came from, it was like this joke that you may have heard that goes, and pray tell, what was beneath the elephants that were holding up the pillars upon which the earth rested? The answer being either, it's elephants all the way down, or suppose we change the subject. And for those who would later posit that a being called God created everything out of nothing, you, of course, have the same question of where God came from. And again, the same desire to change the subject. Now, for theologian Paul Tillich, however, his use of God, it's an equivalent term for being or being itself. For Tillich, God is not a being, not even the greatest of all beings, but rather God would be like the ground, the possibility, the power of that is in and of all beings. So in this understanding, God, if you're going to use the word, is a word that points to being, to somethingness, somethingness that is. Our language breaks down here. But basically, God is a word that points to the mysterious ground of all being. It's a word that points to the mystery that will always be mysterious. In other words, God is not a word that solves the mystery of being, the mystery of existence, but rather is a word that points to that mystery from which all things have emerged and back into which all things fall. In this approach, one doesn't solve the issue of ultimate origins or the question of why there is something rather than nothing. But at least one doesn't avoid it. On the contrary, one contemplates that mystery. And that deep sense of mystery then can inform one's life. And so let me end by briefly speaking about what it has meant to me, the contemplation of this mystery that just gets larger. Well, first, as I've mentioned, there's the wonder, the awe, and the humility in the presence of something that doesn't have to be. The astonishment, the simple astonishment that anything is here at all. I had nothing to do with any of this. It was here before I was. And so I bow my face in humility before that which is infinitely greater than me. Paradoxically, at the same time, however, there is in this approach participation and connection. The recognition that though nothing had to be, yet I am also part of this. And it, this mystery, is part of me. Tat Tvam Asi, the Hindus say, that thou art. You are that. You are part of that mystery. You participate in it. You're part of that creativity. You, me, all of us are part of being, being itself. And here, following the second kind of nothingness, I trace in wonder and awe the evolutionary development by which this pregnant nothingness has evolved into the various shapes and forms that it has, and particularly the wonder that this pregnant nothingness has become consciously aware in creatures like us. I don't know if you noticed at the beginning on the slides, there was this little couplet. It's from someone I know. From a little poem, his name is Quentin Wald. He said in one of his poems, "Why should there be anything and this little light to know it? Why should there be anything and this little light to know it?" And then finally, the contemplation of the possibility of nothingness leads to waking up. Nothing had to be, and yet here everything is. And on my good days, I awake. I awake to what is, rather than to what is not. I meditate on what doesn't have to be and realize that I can't take things for granted. And in that moment, gratitude spontaneously arises. The contemplation of the question of why there is something rather than nothing ultimately leads me to a place of gratitude. And so it's no accident that I have chosen to speak on this subject on this Thanksgiving Sunday.